Welcome to episode 315. We'll talk to Luke Dick. He wrote a bunch of songs for a bunch of people. He's just a really interesting guy. What was awkward was when we finished the interview, I walked him out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, man, because I always try to walk him out and have a little personal talk away from the microphones. I was like, hey, man, have a good day. Good luck. And I was like, I don't know why I said good luck. I'm awkward. I don't know why I said that.
Good luck.
Yeah, I was like, good luck. But he wrote, you know, Eric Church, Randall Lambert. I mean, just such a great songwriter. Did a documentary. So he was a philosophy professor.
Very interesting guy.
Yeah, that's coming up in a minute. All right, let's go. Top five songs of the week. Cole Swindell put out a new song called Some Habits. He actually performed this on the radio show a couple months before it was released. Here is that version.
Because good bourbon is hard to put down that high road. It's hard to stay.
And here is the version that is out today.
Because good bourbon is hard to put down that high road. It's hard to stay on that good book. It's hard to pick up that.
Mitchell Tenpenny has a new EP out called Midtown Diaries. Here's a new song called To Us It Did.
I just did it really going 200 miles an hour. That small town we ran around ain't supposed to feel that big.
Singer-songwriter and this week's guest, Luke Dick, has a new song called Some Things Happen.
It's like one door closes and then another one slams.
At number two, Sam Hunt. He put out a new song called 23.
No matter where I go, no matter what I do, I'll never be 23 with anyone but you. You can marry.
And finally, Casey Musgraves has a new album out called Starcrossed. Here's a new song called Justified.
If I cry just a little.
And the one news story I'll mention, Walker Hayes' Fancy Like lands in the top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. I mean, I watched any SEC game. Every commercial is an Applebee's commercial, and it's him.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. It's wild to watch how that went from being a viral TikTok to a massive hit. Like, hopefully he gets, like, pop play out of this, you know? There you go. Enjoy Luke Dick in just a second. And with Luke Dick, you know, I've seen many photos of you. I have friends who have worked with you. It's just random for me to have not have met someone until this point. Because you're a very established, you know, super well thought of guy, and our paths haven't crossed, have they?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
This is it.
I'm pretty forgettable, though. You are not a forgettable guy. I'm pretty forgettable.
I hide out, you know. I just got my little studio and come out, and I get eat. I eat now and again, and then I pick up my kids, and then I get back to doing whatever it is I'm doing.
What is your studio like?
You know, I bought this house right when I moved to Nashville seven years ago, and it was a garage in the back, and it was unfinished, and I thought that'd be a great place for just to have something close to the house, away from the house. And so then I put these opaque glass doors so I could have some light and put a bunch of skylights in and really dressed it up and made it into a thing. And so that's where I am all the time. I'm currently looking for another spot. I have too many kids. They're beating on the door all the time. So
are you, when you are writing in this room, I assume you do a lot of writing there.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're producing, are you doing more than just demos? Like, will you do anything for a record in your spot?
Yeah. I'm working on the next Miranda Lambert record right now. We're almost done. And a lot of the stuff was when I do demos, I don't think of them as demos. I just am trying to make something that I love. And so I put more time and effort into it. And so maybe some of that stuff makes it onto the record. It may be the pre-production that we just drummed to. There was a single for Kip Moore called The Bull a few years ago. That was just straight up out of my studio. So I'll do whatever out of there. Right now I'm doing a soundtrack for a documentary for, it's actually the soundbed composition for the band Guar. You know the band Guar?
Yeah, crazy. They're crazy looking guys,
yeah,
right?
This is sort of.
Yeah, like monsters.
They're actually alien monsters who populated the human race and then got disgusted with human beings. And so they were really adamant that they get out of here. So anyway,
is that their backstory, really?
their backs. Well, that's the
myth.
Their
fictional backstory.
That's the mythology. Yeah, the true story is that it was a bunch of punk kids in Virginia who they had a punk band. One of them had a punk band, and then this other guy, he was making movies, and he had all these costumes. And the guy said, "Why don't I just put on these costumes, and we'll open for our punk band with this sort of fake metal band." And so that was how Gwar came to be, and then that band became more popular than their regular band.
You mentioned Kip's song, The Bull.
Yeah.
Which was probably my favorite song off that project.
Oh, awesome.
And I remember talking to Kip about it, because I'd played it on the radio show a few times. And it may have even went for a single for a second, or he was talking about it, and he called me, and he goes, "You know what's wrong with this song?" He said, "Nothing with what we did with it." He said, "There are radio..." This is how... Sometimes yeah. dumb radio is.
Yeah.
Because there are radio stations that are up against stations that are named The Bull and don't want to play it because it's going The Bull.
Yep.
Like yeah. if there's a wolf in, I'm just making up a city so no one,
yeah.
in Tucson, there's a wolf country station and a bull country station.
Uh-huh.
The wolf wouldn't play the song The Bull because they felt like it was a commercial for the bull country station.
Yeah, I wish I had that to do over again. I would have named it something else.
I would never have thought of that, though.
Buck me off.
Yeah.
Call it Buck me off.
Did that story get back to you?
Yeah, it did. It was really so frustrating and a surreal look at the kind of things that you're up against to try to make a living as a creative person. You know, I'm just like, wow, that is so ridiculous. But okay, I guess I won't eat this year.
I was reading some about kind of your background, more so than the songwriting, because I'm very familiar with the stuff you've wrote and who you've written with, and mm-hmm. we'll get into that in a bit. But for me, one of the, I would say the, coming from a small town in Arkansas, I'm from a town called Mountain Pine, Arkansas. You're from Oklahoma,
yeah.
so we kind of have similar sensibilities from where we come from.
Sure.
And when I went to college and I studied philosophy, it just kind of wrecked me in the best way.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up in a really small town, had extreme values. And then I started to learn, while there's more, there are deeper thoughts available for me than I've ever tried to think about. And again, it scared me. It wrecked me. I grew. But then when I read that you went off and were an adjunct philosophy professor,
uh-huh.
how does that happen? And when did that happen in your life when you were just so moved by philosophy?
That is a funny coincidence that you studied philosophy. But... in high school, my teachers would feed me stuff that they thought that I would be interested in, and it wasn't philosophy, it was just more thoughtful literature. I had to do some stuff on the Transcendentalist, Henry David Thoreau, and Emerson. I had to, in the 9th grade and 10th grade, and teachers would sort of funnel me toward that. But then when I got in college... I was studying music business for a hot minute, and then like after a half a semester, this teacher's like, "Well, in order to tour with Roy Clark in Russia, you have to ... And I'm just like, I'm so out on this, you know. How touring in Russia with Roy Clark, that just sounds so like, this is our starting point, you know, for whatever. And I'm in Oklahoma, and I'm like, this was like, okay, I'm hedging my bets. So I'm in a band, and I'll just do this music business. Maybe I'll be an executive or whatever. I'm like, this is trash. I'm not doing this. And so then I had this history professor I loved and a philosophy professor that I loved, and I just started, and it was a double major. And in philosophy, it was just interesting questions that I'd thought of a little bit, in a very cursory manner as a high schooler and sort of when your brain comes online. And just the philosophy to me became at first it was like this magical thing that could give me all the answers. And then it was like very clearly not that. It was just this framework for thinking about the questions of freedom. Does freedom exist? Is there such a thing as good? How do you measure good? How do we have thoughts at all? Sort of the, even before psychology and sort of the history of all that and the history of intellectual thought and at all. And I became really interested in it. It was really difficult too. And I was given up on music, and I moved to New York, and I'd had a master's then. I was like, well, I'll get a PhD and that'll be my job. You know, it's good. You get a pension, whatever. I had a kid and I couldn't, you know, I was had artistic aspirations, but my kid, it's like, I can't really tour, you know? And so anyway, about the time that I said I'm going to get a PhD, I started making money, you know, like doing spec music for ads and all this. And I was still making my own music, making my own songs. And kind of that was that. I found a way to be a middle-class citizen with music, and that was always the goal, even as a 10-year-old, you know.
You never had dreams of being a college professor in a massive university teaching philosophy?
It was never a massive university. When I was at, you know, when the kind of the dream, the first little rock and roll band he had died, I was like, I really like, it was this little liberal arts school in Oklahoma City, and I loved it. And I was like, well, I could come back here and I'd be one of the two philosophy professors here. And it seemed like such a sweet life, you know. You get up and you go to school and you teach, and then you go have a lunch, and then you come back and have a meeting or whatever. And that seemed like a dream to me, you know. I mean, I was the first kid in my family to get an education at all. So that seemed like almost a Disney story to me. But then, I mean, because there's nobody, I don't know, what did you say, Mountain Pine?
Mountain Pine. Population 772.
Yeah, yeah. The town that I grew up in, once my mom moved us out to the country, it was, the closest town was 1,500 people, but we were 20 miles away from that. So it was this, like just a community of houses, you know, the closest neighbors are like a mile away or something. And so I think I may be the only person in Cobar, Oklahoma to ever have a philosophy degree. I don't know.
the two things that, and we can get off this in a second, but I really get to talk philosophy because I know nothing. I mean, now I sound like Socrates, but I literally know nothing. but the things that just rattled me was, I remember reading Mark Twain's That Damn Human Race about morality, and if that morals are bad, if we didn't have good, we wouldn't have bad.
Yeah.
Like if there was no such thing as good, we've created good, there wouldn't be bad if there wasn't good. And animals don't have morals, and they're not good or bad or evil. They're living. And I remember being like, I'm not supposed to think about this, but feeling guilty. And then I read The Cave, which I don't know if you taught The Cave at all.
The Allegory of the Cave?
Yes.
Okay.
And I remember because it's, you know, two people trapped in the bottom of a cave, all they can see is fire on a wall, and their whole world is what they can see.
Sure.
And I remember, and one of them's freed and is able to go outside and come back in.
Right.
And he's able to tell the other guy, I saw it, but the other guy, his only known existence is looking at that fire on the wall. And he's like, there's no way that's true. And I'm like, who else has left the cave? I'm the guy that's only seen the fire. And that's a very brief interpretation of that. But I just remember thinking, I am never going to like look at Earth or the world or more than the Earth the same after that.
Well, it's a kind of an utter objectivity, you know, and you have to shake your own cultural notions of reality and stuff like that. An idea that there are no such things as morals or something like this, and that we've created it all, that's scary to a lot of people. To me, it's like this weird thing where, or fate, for instance, you know, that I was destined to be this. I always try not to say things like that, because if I was destined to be this, then it could be no other way. And that means that I'm not free. And to be not free sounds like the most scary thing to me.
Destiny is the opposite of freedom.
Destiny is kind of the opposite of freedom to me. Or if there is such a thing as, you know, predestination or something like that, that all the decisions are made or known somewhere. It's like, oh no, you know, that doesn't sound fun. That sounds like a schedule.
I was doing a little more research on, because my vision and version of you has been the last 10 years or so. But it seemed like for a while you weren't writing country music for a while. Now you're back. Like why'd you quit? I wouldn't say quit. Why did you take a break, and what brought you back?
Yeah. I came to Nashville for a minute, and I just didn't have any luck. You know, I made a record. I was trying to get in a deal. There were things stacked against me just logistically in terms of being a single dad and stuff like this. And so and also people weren't responding in a way. There were outliers, you know, that had some clout or something, said, I really love what you do, blah, 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 blah. But I was like, and this never amounted to anything. And it wasn't like people were picking up my songs. And I'm like, I either don't know how to do this, I'm not savvy enough, or it's just not good enough or something like that.
Did you never think you were ahead of your time?
that's, I think that, like, looking back and listening to the record that I made, that's what it sounds like to me. But I also don't want to be, have delusions of grandeur or something like that. It's just like, music is important to me, but it's also just a snippet of life and reality. And it's a big part, you know, it's a big part. It gives me a lot of joy. But I also don't want to think in terms, like, I have a hard time thinking in terms of that, that you're ahead of your time and that's why it didn't work or whatever. And, but then it, whatever, for whatever reason, it didn't work. And so I left, and then my current publisher called me when I was in New York, and he said, "Hey, do you have any songs for Dierks Bentley?" And I just said, "No." I mean, literally everything that I've written has been in falsetto and also about the afterlife or some sort of afterlife adventure. I mean, it's too fantastical and whimsical for Dierks. I just don't, thank you for calling me. But he will just look me up if you're ever in town. And then one thing led to another, and a few years went by and we met and for coffee, and he's like, "You need to come write with me and at this company, and you need to be writing with Eric, and you don't need to be doing what you think you should be doing. You should be doing what you want to do, and hits will fall out of that, I promise you." And he was right. So between him and getting in the right rooms and having just the opportunity to show somebody like Eric Church a song or an idea for a song, that led to a lot of things. And Kip was a big proponent early on too. It was like, I didn't have any hits and he was coming over because he liked the sounds coming out of my studio, and we would work on stuff. And I think it was the Wild Ones record. I got a couple of songs on there and we just worked. But then Eric and then Nally Hemby and I started writing together, and it was like almost like we fed off of each other's creativity. And so we were like trying to not one up each other. It was like us like pushing each other, like trying to make each other like smile or get excited about a song. And so we'd bring in an idea or a sound or something like that. And that was a real joy. And then she would also sing my praises. It was like, I probably owe her $100,000 in PR fees, you know, around town. Brought Miranda into the room, and that became a relationship. And it's meant a lot of joy and a lot of songs with her, but that was kind of the beginning of it. It was running into a publisher who believed in what I did naturally instead of trying to curb it to meet a market demand or something like that. And that's not really where I shine anyway. And I find that if I feel like I'm a cat in a corner when I'm writing a song, then it's usually not going to be awesome. It's going to be an average kind of thing, day or whatever.
I've talked to Miranda and Cassie Ashton, Nally Hemby, those that you mentioned there, and they all say the same thing about you, is that, you know, you're very out of the box and with ideas. I mean, that's the easy way to describe you to people who don't have to write songs. Like, do you feel like you're known as the out of the box guy?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't feel like, I love Ashley Gourley, but I don't think that I have that kind of potential in terms of commercial success as Ashley Gourley, because I feel like there's like five artists at any given time that might be interested in what I'm doing, because it doesn't fit the subject might not fit into the way that they see the market. But I honestly am just trying to get ideas that make me excited to write the song. And also it's not so serious, you know. I mean, there are plenty of songs that don't necessarily have to be serious. I don't know, Pink Sunglasses or something like that. That's really fun. That's really joyous to write. I think in the indie rock band I have, Hey Steve, is all about this sort of both digging in weird to weird pop culture, but also having fun while you're doing it and being, self-deprecating a little bit. I don't know. That's, to me, country has a sweet spot for self-deprecation too, that I really love. It's been a part of the history of country. But anyway, that's a long way around. Am I the out of the box guy? I feel like just maybe objectively, yes. It doesn't feel like it. It's all in my head. So it feels like it's mine.
It's your own box.
So it's my own box. Yeah, yeah. So I'm just like, yeah, this is what would be cool. And everybody else is like, why would you do that? I mean, I've pitched songs, ideas before that were hits that people were like, what does that mean? Why would you do that? Or something like that. And it's like, then it goes on to be a number one.
You seem like a guy that would need an aesthetic in a room. Does your studio have an aesthetic where people, they're like, this is the Luke Dick aesthetic?
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, I re-upped it a little bit over COVID, but, you know, I have objects that I love or that are close to me, and the color scheme is just like, there's a really beautiful mustard wall, and then, you know, this painting that I saw, it was just these, like, birds in the mist, you know, and it's like things that are impressionistic, I guess, that aren't particular things that are art-wise in the studio. I don't like having awards up on the wall. That's the past. That seems, it never made me feel good to walk in and see awards. I mean, it felt like something.
As you walked out of a fireplace out there with like four ACMs up there.
I'm talking about in a creative space. But then just things that you like, things that make you feel good. Do you love it or is it beautiful? Isn't that a question about the aesthetic of the interior? Do you love it? Is it beautiful? Is it functional? Those kind of questions. But then colors, I really love colors. And so my one wall is this really deep navy-ish kind of hue. And then the back wall is this sort of mustard color and all this greenery and stuff like that. Things that live and breathe, you know. But yeah, it's important to me to feel good in a space. And a songwriting space is pretty intimate, you know. I mean, you're around somebody for 6 hours, and usually if you're in this business, there's some sensitivity about you, and so you never know what you're going to end up talking about. And I mean, I remember one day it was me and Laura Veltz and Jesse Joe Dillon, and we sat down, and it seemed like two-thirds of the people were having, you know, sort of turmoil at the time. And so it was this outpour of, you know, oh, my God, and this, and this, and this, and I can't believe that, and this. And it was really heartfelt. It was a safe space, you know. And then we broke for lunch and came back and wrote this song called Tattoo, which is this super flippant song about wishing that you were a tattoo because you could be on somebody 24/7. And so it'd be turned into this thing. But to have a space that welcomes that kind of openness, that's what I hope for. I feel like that's when really good stuff can happen, either something with depth or something, you know, surface level, fun. It's all necessary to me.
When you started writing with Eric, was he already having success, or was it early on?
It was the Mr. Misunderstood record, so he'd had a serious amount of success by the time I was writing with him.
So you start writing with him. I mean, to you as a creative, is that intimidating to write with him, or is it kind of refreshing because he also, you know, went a different angle at his success?
Yeah. I was in New York, and when I was living there, somebody showed me Smoke a Little Smoke, and they said, have you heard this? And I listened, and I'm like, is this what they're doing in Nashville now? And it gave me hope, you know, that there could be something creatively interesting, sonically interesting. And I feel like Jay Joyce kind of paved the way sonically for somebody like me to be here. I really have a lot of gratitude for what those two have done together. It's no small feat to break in with a different sound. But to more point at your question a little bit better, there's always a bit of intimidation. It doesn't matter how successful or not commercially successful the artist is coming in. So, but that was, you know, the first chance at an A-list situation for me to prove myself or whatever. But I had sent him this idea through my publisher that he loved, and it was Kill a Word, and there was already an idea happening there in the first stanza and refrain, and he's like, I love this, let's finish it. And so he came in and we finished that, and then it was like, it took us like an hour to finish the song. And then it was me and him and Jeff Hyde, who plays in his band too, who's a great writer. And then he had the idea for Around Here Buzz. And so he kind of had a Around Here Buzz, Around Here Buzz. And so then we just sort of took off on that. And it just felt natural. Once you get in, everybody's a human, you know, it's like there's no, I don't know, there's no, there's different kinds of magic to different human beings, you know, and Eric is definitely somebody with a special kind of charisma and a special kind of creative capacity and intellect to me. But as a human being or trying to impress another human or something like that, it's like, look, you know, we all woke up today. We all needed breakfast and all that stuff. So let's just, you try to put stardom or something like that out of your head. I try to, and not be, I guess, motivated or dissuaded or feel insecure around that kind of a status. I'm trying to think if there was somebody that I'd be so starstruck that it would be difficult to write with. You know, Tom Waits, I don't know.
You kind of sound like Tom Waits right now when you're talking.
I'm Bob Dylan, I guess. You know, if you had to go write a song with Bob Dylan, that would probably be one of the most intimidating things, situation. I remember this is not an intimidating person, but this guy came over and he was an Englishman and he had these hits in the 80s, these pop rock hits, and they were really good ones. And I kept playing like guitar stuff, and he's like, he'd look at me and he'd go, "That's not very inspiring, is it?" What do you do to that? You know, I'm just like, what do you got? And he's like, I'm more of a lyrics guy. Here's a list of titles. And the titles were like, All Night Long, All Night, All of Everything. And I'm just like, are you fucking kidding me? What is this?
Are you a lyric or a melody guy at heart when you start to write?
I can't separate them really, you know. When Natalie, it's different for different rooms. When I get around Natalie and I have a melody already with something and with the phrasing, and she wants to change the melody, I usually defer to her because I really believe in her abilities to make a melody. There are a few other people like that I, when they say, "Man, I think this melody could be better," I'm like, "All right, let's check it. Let's scrap it. Let's see what's up." But I really want to marry it all, because you can't just send somebody the lyrics to a song and expect it to speak to them off of a page. I mean, there's a whole thing happening there. It's like, that's the beauty of music or songs in general, is that there's a sound, there's a, you know, there's a chord progression, there's a lyric, and there's a melody on top of it. So it's hard for me to say that I'd be one thing.
When you write, are you writing based on, will you just chase lyrics, or will you sometimes just create a melody and then insert lyrics into it later?
Both. Laura Velz does this to me. I hope she's listening right now, because when we write, I'll turn around and I'll start, try to get the track going. You know, it's like, okay, we got the first verse. Let me just put a little bass part in here. I'll turn around, and Laura's such a prolific lyricist that she'll be done with the second verse. I'm like, wait a minute, I like this song. Can I participate, please? Can you just hold on? Chew, you know, have a story, eat some chips or something, and let me do this bass part and I'll contribute. But there have been times that the melody has come first. You know, it's like, you know, you start playing and something will just spill out of you, and then you just work around the vowels. The vowels might lead you to a phrase or something like that, you know. I read the Keith Richards book, and he talked about the way that they did that, and I don't think it's uncommon to do that. Life, that's the book from Keith Richards, and he said, he had a name for it, you know, the way that they do it, but it's, you know, you're just playing a chord, and you're, and so then whatever vowel you sing that feels the most natural, you might lean toward a word with that vowel sound. And then you have to work the concept around the vowel sound or something like that. You know, it's a really such a, songwriting is really weird, but I do find that when I listen to songs and I feel like that's a good melody, those are the wrong vowel sounds or something, you know, I'm like, I can't understand the lyric. It's not, the lyric's not sticking out to me because the, it's all mushed in there in a way and the vowels aren't popping and the, there's too many words or too many, too not enough words. So there's like an economy and that's all subjective too, right? It's just like, does that sounds too like too many words to me? It doesn't sound like too many words to that artist or that person singing it.
I'm going to compare you as a lyricist and a songwriter to Eminem, which you may have never been compared to, but
whoa.
When I listen to Eminem, he bends rhymes. Sometimes he doesn't rhyme, but still rhymes. And a lot of, or at least some of your writing, you don't even chase a rhyme. There just aren't rhymes where there should be, where traditionally rhymes are. I shouldn't say should be rhymes.
Yeah, yeah.
There aren't rhymes where traditionally rhymes are.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that purposeful on your part to not put rhymes there, or is it just purposeful to put those words there and they just don't happen to rhyme?
I feel like when you get down to it, it's like, it, especially if you're chasing a lyric and it's like, is this lyric working? Is this idea working? You just run with it. And then it's, I don't want to say it's not intentional. Like the way to say it's not my intention to say every song needs to rhyme like this. Or let's try some rhymes in the middle of this phrases rather than at the end of the phrases, which is typical. I feel like you just, all you're left with in any creative endeavor is your own aesthetic intuition. And you have to go with what moves you. And when anytime, I mean, there's been countless artists that come in and we end up with a song that I don't care about. And that's okay because they're saying, no, I don't want to do this because I want to do that. And I'm like, well, that does not in my head, you know, or heart or whatever. I'm like, well, that doesn't do anything for me, but it's your career, you know, it's your artistic impulse that you're chasing. So chase it then. And I hope that I hope it works if I like you.
And the demo to Kill a Word.
Yeah.
Which is you singing.
Yeah.
Which we have it right here.
Oh, well.
I'd like to play a little bit of it here.
I'd put upset down in its place. I'd squeeze the life out of disgrace. Lay over under 6 cold feet of dirt. If I could only kill a word.
So, have you not heard that?
You
in a
steal
while?
That? Do you steal that?
We were at your house last night. We're in the that's why I know so much about your studio.
Hacked your computer.
Broke in last night.
Wow.
Change the code.
Why?
Is it a, or how prevalent is it that if you're writing with or for like an Eric, that that person doesn't sing the demo? And is that purposeful so the demo doesn't get out with his voice on it?
It wasn't purposeful. He just said, put your vocal on it. I like what you're doing. I'm out. Do your thing. I want to hear what you do. And then there's sometimes where, especially if it's a female artist, where I'm less inclined to go do a vocal on it. And for a couple of reasons, one is it's shrewd, you know, it's like if they just hear a dude on there, then it sounds like a dude song, you know, but if you write it with the artist who's female and then another female artist, the other female writer, if the other female writer sings it, it makes more sense to me, but I don't like, really, I feel like it shoots you in the foot a little bit. Unless it's somebody like Miranda that we know each other well enough to where it's like, not like she's like, oh, this doesn't sound like this. She can hear through that stuff. I trust her to hear through that stuff. But generally, if an artist is there, and especially if it's an artist that I don't work with that often, I'm going to try to get them to sing it because I want to hear what they sound like on it too. And also see if you did okay or you didn't. What I mean by that is, sometimes you write all these melodies, you write this song, and somebody sings on it just doesn't sound good, you know? And so if you're off the mark in terms of a melodic structure or something like that, you'll be able to hear it when they get on the microphone. It's like, they're not really capable of singing that, or they are really great at it, or it's kind of in the middle. Maybe we shouldn't have gone that high, and you change the key, those kind of technical decisions like that. So if we're the only writers in the room, oftentimes I get tasked with singing the demo on it. And I'm generally happy to do that. It's fun to me. It's a creative endeavor, especially if I love the song.
When Bluebird comes out and it's a massive radio success, and I think it was the first massive radio song for Miranda in a long time. Mm-hmm. I remember her saying that, like, yeah. You know, she had just had a record that double album had done so wonderful, but mm-hmm. it didn't translate into singles. But Bluebird comes and just crushes. It's the number one and was won two Grammys?
No, we nominated for two Grammys.
You nominated for two Grammys? Yeah. Did you go?
It was when COVID was happening.
Yeah, so you still...
No, I bought a suit and in my closet it sits.
So you didn't even put it on for the night of, as they were doing it on the internet. No. So is that cool to you to be nominated for a Grammy, or is it to you, is that just a piece of metal that represents, and what does representation even mean?
I would really be lying if I didn't say that I would not want to win a Grammy. I mean, I would love to say that I won a Grammy. Sometimes I catch myself, you know, when you win something, and it's like, I'm always thankful to win something. There is a truth for me to the fact that when you write a song like that, that is really meaningful to you, that nothing compares to the day that you wrote it with your friends. And then you heard and then you played it back and you heard and you sang on it and you listened to the demo and you get excited about it. Nothing compares to that joy. Winning awards is, it's another, like, just kind of hurrah at the end, you know, that the hard work and the beautiful work is already done. And Amy Poehler calls it the pudding. You know, you've already eaten the meat and all that stuff, and pudding is nice, you know, but you don't need it. You're already full, kind of everything. That said, if the Grammy, any Grammy voters are out there, if I'm up for anything next year, please vote for me.
One of my favorite songs from you is Velvet Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
From Casey.
Yeah.
I ain't never gonna take you down, making everybody jealous.
Do you ever have an idea for a song or a title like Velvet Elvis and have to Google and see if it's been done, because it just sounds so perfect and you're like, surely somebody's done this before?
That'll happen sometimes. And if it's like something obscure somewhere, it's like titles aren't copywritten. So, and also, it's like, again, Lionel Richie's, you know, All Night Long, and then Beyonce had a song called All Night. It was great. But something like Velvet Elvis, to me, that's a little trickier one. Nat and I have wrote a song called Taxidermy, and it's just like...
From Casey, yeah, or Cassie Ashton.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, you can't, you know, it's like, we've had a few artists that come in, and it's just like, do you want to... I got this title called I Can't Make You Love Me. And I'm just like, ooh, you know, or Blackbird, you know, it's like you can't, there's something about those I don't know that you can do again. I would scratch my head if somebody came out with Bluebird again in the next couple of years, you know, at least in the genre of country for sure. So people don't normally do that. I've caught myself, I had a title one time called Don't It. And I wrote it. And then a week later, Billy Currington comes out with a song called Don't It. And so I was like, there's a waste of 12 hours.
Did you go back and try to find another angle to rename it?
It's called Do It Now. If anybody's out there listening and wants to cut it, you can... email my publisher and I'll send it right over.
You've got two of the three singles so far from Miranda's newest record.
Yeah.
Do you kind of know where she's leaning when a project is done? Like, I really feel like these that we wrote could be singles. Or do you just sit and guess with everybody else?
I kind of guess with everybody else, you know. I feel it in my heart, you know, and I feel like that could be something big. But then there are so many people who make those decisions because... I don't know because whatever, but, you know, there are people at the label who have an idea, and the promo people at the radios and all this, you know, it's just like, that's another game. It's real difficult for me to get wrapped up in unless I want, even more anguish than the music business deals out, you know? So I try to chill out on not, it's not that I don't hope that I have singles, because I want, you know, songs that I believe in to be heard. But I do try to maintain some kind of mindfulness or zen around what's happening behind the scenes, because I don't think I've changed anything one time. You know, it's like, oh, if I just told them this, or, you know, sort of some kind of Varys, right, from Game of Thrones, some kind of whisperer, you know, behind the scenes, making things happen. It's like, that's not my game.
What about if you cut a song like you, like Dirk's Cut the Mountain, which you guys wrote?
Yeah.
And so you write the mountain, he cuts the mountain, and then it becomes the title track. Now, to some people, that's great, because the whole project, maybe the tour is named after it, could be a single. But to some people, it's, oh no, it's the title track, that'll never be a single.
Wow, you know, I don't know. That's a great set of facts to figure out. Is there any title of a record that's ever been a hit? Like recently?
I'm going right now. Brothers Osborne have a single now, because this is their record called, it's like You're Not Like Us, or, and it's also their single.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not for everyone. Is that the name of it?
I wrote that. Yeah, it's not for everyone.
the album Skeletons.
Oh, it is? Okay, never mind. Never mind. But you wrote that? You wrote that Brothers Osborne song? That's from Skeletons, though, huh?
Yeah.
Maybe it's the tour. Okay, that's what it is. The tour is called the We're Not For Everyone tour.
Tours are a plus. Name and getting your... There was the Burning Man tour for a minute. I get that was a good one. I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, and that's something we should look at, too, because most people act like they don't like it if the record is named after the song they wrote. But I don't know if it's just some fallacy that has now happened.
I'm ready to break it now. I'm just like, I don't even care about that rule. It's like, surely there's a way around that.
Do you want to call Dirks right now and do the mountain?
Yeah, put out the mountain. I know you're two singles past that record, but let's go back. Who's to say you can't?
There are rules no more.
You know, Lizzo did that. It was like, I was loving on Lizzo. You know, Maddie and Tay turned me on to Lizzo. This was in 2016 or something like that. And I got so into it. And then I was like, man, these are bangers. And then I don't know what happens, but she has a song that's big and she has a moment. And then they just start releasing everything as singles. As everything starts going as radio that were 4 or 5 years old because they're so awesome. And I was like, see, there's no rules. There's no rules. You can do anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, and Dirk, go put out the mountain.
Dirk, put out the mountain. We know you're listening. That's a wild story, because even that was an old song.
Yep. And I feel good as hell.
Yeah. We're pure melody. Right? We're both melody guys right now. Dirks, Breland Hardy, Beers on Me, which is a single right now.
Yeah.
Swing on by, bring whatever's been on your mind. Locals on tap and bottles on ice. Living on feel-good standard time. My card's on the bar. You got nowhere to be if you don't come through, buddy. That's on you, because the beer's on me.
So you have a song that's out today, Friday, because this will be heard on Friday.
Uh-huh.
Something's happened. And so, but this is not from your documentary.
This is a whole new thing. Whole new thing.
So is this...
I'm so over that documentary.
Are you?
I'm kidding. You just got to keep making stuff. You know, what else is there to do? I don't know. You just keep making stuff.
Keep creating and feeling good, and hopefully something hits. And if it doesn't, keep going. But what... You put out Something's Happened, which is not Hey Steve.
No.
Which is not the documentary.
No.
This is it feels like a country song.
Yeah, it's
song.
A country-ish song.
Ish, okay. Yeah. So what's the, why now, why this?
I just, honestly, I'd put out Polyester, which was part of the track, and people gravitated toward it, and they were like, why aren't you putting out more songwriter of your stuff from Nashville songwriting? And I said, That's a great question. I mean, I have a lot of songs that I love. And so then I was like, I'm just going to put together a record. I don't care how long it takes. I'll just put together a record. And I mean, this will be a part of the record. And when will the record come out? I don't know. March. How about March?
That sounds good for now. Yeah, why not?
You have me back in March. Yeah, why not? We can talk about it.
Do you want to tour?
Yeah, I want to tour.
Well, you said earlier, you know, you couldn't because of the kid.
Yeah.
But now, can't, you know?
Well, you know, things are different. You know, you can, the way that the country tours, you can go out and play. Steve will do 30 or 40 shows a year. If we rock through this festival season and play a few festivals, it's
Hey, Steve plays 30 to 40 shows a year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a touring schedule itself.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, why do you say that? I mean, even if you just
look... going out for 3 days, you know, here, there, 10 times.
Oh, listen, I get it. The country tour and, you know, alternative pop tour, all different animals.
Yeah.
But 30 to 40 dates while being a professional songwriter, doing it as much as you do it, that's a significant amount of work.
It is a significant amount of work. but this has been the recurring theme of my career. Do you want to play for people? Yes. And then life gives you all these caveats, logistical caveats. Do you want to also go write with Dierks for 3 or 4 days? Yes. You want to go, to your kid's spelling bee? Yes. And so I've luckily found a management team who understand, the fluid, concept of my schedule, and it works. You know, it's like I put together a living. I'm able to go play, and if there's a good opening gig, or like Steve's doing some hard tickets, we go do a few hard ticket dates and play a few festivals and have a good time. It's like I don't know, life is, that's what I want to do. You know, it brings me joy. And so you go do it. And also when you see people, when you're playing for people and the songs do something for you and you see them in the environment of a live show, which is really kind of where music is the benchmark to me for what music is. It's a communal thing, you know, it's not just headphones for people. There was a switch flipped in me a few years ago, just playing with a guitar and being able to tell stories and have a moment with people. And then Steve is a whole different beast where it's just a sort of crazy, raucous live show. And like Cadillac 3 had us, we opened the Ryman for them last week and it was, such a rad experience. I've never played the Ryman before, and to do it opening for a country band with an indie rock band, it's sort of absurdist twist, you know, it's really fun.
I appreciate your ability to try to save breaths by not saying "Hey" in front of "Hey Steve." Like you keep calling us Steve.
Yeah, Steve.
I mean, I like that you guys have really abbreviated. It's a big difference.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
I mean, hey. One breath.
Well, we called it Steve for a while, and my management said we can't do this anymore because every time Steve Aoki releases.
So it really was Steve for a while.
Yeah, it was Steve for a while. I was just like, all right, I get it. Fine. Practicalities.
Here is a clip of Run Through the City.
I run through the city because I got no time. I run through the city because it's mine. I want to hear my heartbeat.
Reed, our guy shooting video over there, he went to, Reed, where did you go to his show?
It was at the Basement East.
And when you went, how were you put on to Steve? Hey, Steve.
Actually, some buddies of mine were opening for you. Joey Broadnax.
Oh, yeah. They were awesome.
Yeah, I love those guys.
The ladder out there.
Yeah, they're crazy, man. Mm-hmm. So I went to go see them, and then Steve threw it down. It was amazing.
And he said he came back and was like, he had to Google it. I was like, wait, that's the same guy.
Crazy.
It's like you're living two different lives, though.
Yeah,
ish.
It's, you know, Hey Steve's pretty cathartic sort of situation where it's almost like you wake up from it's like you've had like an internet bender or something like that, and you wake up from it, and like you just sort of, these are the lyrics, you know, sort of stream of consciousness lyrics, but you're also having a really good time while you're doing it. That's kind of the vibe.
Wrote a couple other songs here. Settling Down, which I thought should have been a number one. I mean, it was ready. It was right there.
Yeah, what happened?
Hey, listen, I don't know. People blame me for stuff. I have nothing to do with programming radio. I get on the air and talk, and they throw some songs around me, and that's the day.
What happened?
But I was, I really felt like that song will be one of hers, though, that it doesn't matter what number it was, it will hang out and be a part.
People don't know whether something goes number one or not.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Pink Sunglasses, what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Which she did this at maybe the CMA.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
One of my favorite moments was looking out and Jada Pinkett was rocking out. She had glasses on. She was just like stoically nodding to the song.
You mentioned Dirks and he did Burning Man Tour, which is, you wrote Burning Man.
Yeah.
And then he did The Mountain, which you, the album was called The Mountain. You had both. You had the tour and the.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I made money from that. Like if you put your title on the side of a freighter,
you can't trademark a title.
And his tour now is Beers on Me.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, so anytime, I don't know. There's some lawyers listening out there. If you guys would just figure out how to make people pay like a quarter every time they see the side of a truck.
I am such a Cassie Ashton fan.
Yeah, she's great.
Like I think she is kind of the undiscovered, like. She may have been, and I hate to just use this term, but we were just saying it a few minutes ago, slightly ahead of her time because she was very progressive, and she's already going to be sitting there ready when it gets to her.
Yeah, yeah,
like she's,
yeah.
And she's such an artist and just a creator, music. Obviously, she can sing. She makes clothes like crazy.
Yeah, I feel like there's such a spirit to her.
Yeah, and so she's like the untapped that one day it's going to just be massive from her.
Totally, I feel that.
Taxidermy, you mentioned that one. Here's a clip of that. I mean, what a jam. What a jam. Violins. I mean, you have so many. We can't do them all. But, you know, you have a song that's out today that I want people to check out. And the record could come out any day. Let's just say that. The whole album could come out any day.
Any day.
So check this song out and just and every day look back.
Yeah, and then let's make it awesome, and then if Kenny Chesney wants to cut it too, he can go cut it.
Would any of the songs that you put on your album be available if someone wants to also cut it and put it out?
Yes.
Nice. See, that's all one word.
Yes.
Would you cut for this album any of the songs you'd written for other people that you love so much?
I feel maybe not that have been released. Not, I feel like, you know, people have heard that enough. I feel like there could be more.
Take is extremely different. I know you say that, and you've been involved in the intricacies of writing the early stages, maybe not in the studio in all of them or any of them, but I feel like you have such a different style and vibe to it.
Yeah. You mean the record?
If you were to, I'll give you an example. Nico Moon, who wrote a lot with Zach Brown.
Yeah.
He wrote, I got some
Homegrown.
Yeah.
And we wrote it with Zach, but Zach put it on. He's like, oh, that's not how we wrote it. He's like, I wrote it like this. And he enjoys Zach's version, but he puts it out and it's kind of.
Oh, whoa. Okay.
Like, do you picture any of those songs like that or are you just out?
You know, it's funny because a lot of the songs that end up on people's records are either like maybe I produced it or partly produced it or played some stuff on it and it came from my demo or something. So it's like, I don't know what I would do differently, you know, in terms of because it was, I feel like the creative. The sonic creative stamp was already on there, so it's kind of tricky to me to go in there. And it's like, oh yeah, they just took Eric's voice off and just put Luke's voice on. It's like I don't want to do that. I'm do something. There's plenty more songs to write. Plenty more songs to write.
You guys can also check out Red Dog, which is your documentary.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You make any money off that?
Yeah, I think I've broken even on it.
Now that's a win.
Yeah, it is a win.
Yeah, that's a win.
It was a labor of love. And so it's like when you really do the balance sheet on everything, well, I drove here and I drove there and I ate, you know, chicken tenders here, whatever, you know, you start racking it up and it's expensive to make movies. And it was just me and a couple other people making it. I think we finally broke even and it's, but more than that, to me, it's like we can, the email boxes are kind of flooded with stories and stuff from people who watched the film. And I had a similar childhood, or I had a child that was kind of like this, and it was just like this. And then my dad was in a biker gang and blah, 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 blah. And all that to say is that people found it meaningful. I found it meaningful doing it. I knew, didn't ever think I was going to get rich off making that. I always just found that it was an interesting place to be creative. And once I started doing it, it was really exciting to me. And also it was really fun to make music around that, to make music, to create an experience that, with an intention. So that was, where it really kind of was a concept record, that the concept was the film, you know?
And that was Polyester and Blazer. We're yeah. both off of that,
that's
right?
That's right. That's right.
Oh, here we go. Yeah. It's almost like we're prepared.
There we go. It's going over there.
I can hear him back home
singing, hail, hail, train of park people, got a new car.
All right, new song out today. Something's happened. We've spent an hour here. You're a really entertaining guy.
Hey, man, thanks for having me on here. I'm glad to be entertaining people.
Everything about you. When you drove up to the gate.
Uh-huh. What did I do?
Your shirt, your sunglasses, your presence. I'm looking at you at all angles. Like,
I pulled
all right.
up in a minivan and like this.
That was what was entertaining, because I tell you why. When you pulled up, I looked on the camera.
Uh-huh.
It was like, boop, push a button. Look at it.
Yeah.
And I didn't say anything back because I hit the button. It goes, come on in, whatever it says, right? But I said, this is a very successful guy. And most people that come over here show up in their big trucks or their fancy cars. And he pulls up in a minivan. And I was like, Reed, I don't know if that's him or not. But if it is, that's awesome. He just showed up in a minivan.
I can't remember. I pulled up to a right one time in the minivan. Maybe nobody saw it. I pulled up in, and then in the right, it's like, hey, man, you know, my truck. If my wife ever made me buy a minivan. And I was like, whoa, I didn't realize there was so much identity. And I said, tied to a vehicle. And also, you don't even have cows or anything. And then I was like, also, have you seen minivans? It's like they are geared. It's like they're for a band person, or they're so practical. Like the levels at which you put children or cram children into seats and stuff, it's like perfect. And you can push the button and all the stuff comes up. I mean, I might get a Tesla one day or something like that, but then it's not coming anytime soon.
Well, that being said, you're entertaining in every way.
Good.
From your arrival to your departure.
You had a British lady. She, access granted.
Yes, that's what she said says. Up there. Yeah. That's what it is. Not yeah. come on in. It's yeah. access granted. Yes.
I love
right.
that.
Luke Dick, follow him at Luke Dick. You guys check out Something's Happen. And then also you can still go and see Red Dog, which you can get on Amazon.
Yeah, Hulu.
It's on Hulu?
Yeah, Hulu, Amazon.
Which Hulu may be the way, because Hulu, you already have the service.
Yeah, there you go. And Amazon, it was part of Amazon Prime, but anyway.
But do you buy it on Amazon Prime, or is it one of the free?
I don't even know. I don't know. Those are like some mountain in the sky that make those decisions.
That's it. At Luke Dick. Luke, thanks, man.
Thank you.